This is Here's How, Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast, presented by William Campbell.
Thank you for downloading episode 44 of Here's How. Feminism has a long and distinguished history. A more recent arrival is the men's rights movement. On this podcast, I'll be asking a spokesman for Men's Voices Ireland if they really have anything to be campaigning about.
Here's How is Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast. Make your view heard. Just dial 076 603 5060 and tell the world what you're thinking. Your voicemail may be included in the next podcast. You can find tips on recording your contribution and other ways to contact the show at hereshow.ie/call.
James Behan is a PhD candidate in Trinity. He's also a staff writer for the University Times there. And he's also a spokesperson for the group Men's Voices, which was established in 2014. James, what is Men's Voices for?
Men's Voices is a group, I guess you could call us a political group. And we are dedicated to basically putting various issues that we are concerned with, issues that concern men. Mm-hmm. But to be honest with you, they're really societal issues. They're much broader than just men's issues. And basically Men's Voices is aiming to, as the name might indicate, you know, get those men's voices out there into the discourse, because we think that these are important issues. And we also think that they don't really get the attention that they deserve by and large from the media and from, well, people in general.
Okay, there's been feminist groups of one sort or another, existing for at least the past 100 years, coming from the suffragettes onwards.
Yeah.
And mostly they were concerned with winning equal rights for women. Do men really need to push back against that? Have we come that far?
I wouldn't describe our group as a pushback movement against feminist groups. I would actually be more inclined to liken it to different groups researching different kinds of illnesses. So we're not a charity, but, you know, there are organizations researching, you know, breast cancer and other kinds of cancer, and they're not necessarily competing with one another. They're just sharing a common space and trying to popularize, the things that concern them. Mm-hmm. So I really think there's no problem whatsoever with our group coexisting with other groups, lobbying for, rights, or advocating for positions of other people, so women's groups, other types of men's groups, minority advocacy groups, etc.
Okay, I understand what you're saying, but I was looking at your website, which I'll put a link to in the show notes for this, and one issue that's raised fairly prominently on your website is domestic violence against men, and one of the slogans I saw there was that when domestic violence against women is resolved, that's only solving half the problem. It seems a little bit outlandish to suggest that half of the problem of domestic violence is male victims. Are you really standing over that?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a huge body of research internationally and in this country which shows that when you look at the broad problem of intimate partner violence, it's very close to parity in most cases with men and women equally likely to be perpetrators and victims.
What exactly is close to parity?
The number of people who suffer from intimate partner violence and the number of people perpetrating. So it is not a gendered issue in the way that it's often portrayed.
Okay, let me just challenge you on one thing on that. Now, no doubt it occurs that female partners in heterosexual relationships, female partners may use violence against their male partners. It may be also the case that males have such a strong taboo against hitting a woman that they don't hit back. That clearly wouldn't be the case all of the time, but it might happen sometimes. But inevitably, men are on average physically considerably stronger than women, and for whatever reason, men are much more likely to be in full-time employment and earn more money than women. Doesn't that mean that they have at least two potential escapes from whatever domestic violence there is that is not open to the same degree to women?
Well, I suppose it would depend on the particular arrangements of the household. I agree that being physically stronger than your partner, which is not always the case, by the way. I know plenty of guys who would be considerably weaker than their female partner. Just
but in any given two randomly matched male and a female, overwhelmingly likely it is likely that the male is stronger.
That's true, but I'm not entirely convinced that physical strength is the main component behind intimate partner violence. For example, if you look at the, I believe it was the 2005 National Crime Council report, mm-hmm. when they were looking into this phenomenon, I may be wrong on the date about that, but the essence of the report was that in many of the cases, a majority of the cases, when they interviewed victims of IPV, they actually found that the worst aspect of IPV for them was not necessarily the physicality, it was more the emotional harm, the undermining of their personhood over time, mm-hmm. and the betrayal by someone they thought that they were close to, hurting them, not just with, you know, the physical aspects of it, but sort of into their mind, into their psyche. And that is, to my mind, genderless, because I don't think it depends on how tall or how strong you are. You can abuse your partner.
That may be true in terms of the psychological damage, but in terms of the capacity to escape, the likelihood of any given household being one where the man has a full-time job which pays better is much greater than the likelihood of that household being one where the woman is the sole person with a full-time job that pays better.
I suppose, yes, based on the averages, there are men tend to earn on average more and are much more likely to be the breadwinner. But I would say that there is also a great wealth of services out there for women who are victims of IPV, which, by the way, I think is fantastic.
By IPV, you mean domestic violence?
So women do have a lot of great resources to go to. I don't think it's actually very much the same for men. If you look at AMEN, which is the domestic violence, intimate partner violence group for men, they don't run shelters. They have a single office in Meath. They're essentially confined to there. And they're a relatively small organization by comparison. So yes, while it may be the case that an average man is more likely to have the financial means to kind of get out of there, they don't have services by and large for those who maybe aren't able to get out of there or who aren't.
I'm familiar with Women's Aid, and in many cases they're literally overrun and on occasions have had to turn away women who then have had to gone back to extremely abusive partners simply because they don't have the capacity. Are you aware of any refuges for men, male victims of domestic violence?
I'm not entirely sure if there aren't a small minority of refuges. I just know that the group I mentioned there, AMEN, mm-hmm. do not offer the service. They don't have the capacity for it, or they haven't gone into it. So I would like, obviously,
but when,
I'd like
when,
to see
when we observe that a particular service isn't available, one of the reasons for that may be that there's simply no demand for it.
Well, I would be very skeptical that there's not necessarily demand for it. Again, if you look at some of the reports we have from this country, when you look at the number of women who actually report IPV, it's not ideal. It's around 30%, which is still quite low. That's to the Gardaí, by the way. Mm-hmm. For men, it's about seven times less. So it's, you know, 5%. They don't report it. And this is from surveys of people, not through law enforcement, but from an academic or report for the government. So they, you know, we don't actually know how big the problem is to an extent, because it's probably underreported. It isn't very often broached in the popular discourse. There's a perception that, you know, men can't be victims because they're on average physically stronger, which isn't true. And there's also a perception that even if they were victims, they're able to handle it. They're physically stronger, so they can sort it out themselves, which again may not necessarily be true in all situations.
Okay, I want to move on to one other issue.
And
on the Men's Voices website, you mentioned family law and what you perceive as discrimination against men. Can you set that out for me?
Absolutely. So we know from a PhD thesis from a woman named Roisin O'Shea, I hope I'm getting her name right. She did a lot of work going into family courts a couple of years ago for her thesis. And what we know from this is basically that if you're going into the family court system, if you're having a judicial separation or a divorce, the overwhelming likelihood, if you're a man, is that you're going to be out of your home. You're going to be expected to pay more or less for everything, regardless of your own ability to pay. You're going to have very little access to your children, even if you're given a joint custody by the judge. It's effectively sole custody for the mother. So you're going to probably be visiting your children, you know, a few hours a week, maybe even every second weekend. And you're not really looking at a very favorable outcome. So former Minister Alan Shatter actually has written in his book back at the end of last century, maybe it was early 2000s, that even if you're a, you know, if you're a father with a credible case for custody, that you'd be a good father or perhaps even the better carer, you're going to face an uphill battle in our system to have custody of your children.
So first of all, just on the raw figures, you're correct. Where there's contested custody, mothers are awarded custody or sole custody or predominantly the custody the overwhelming number of times. But do you think that that is maybe a function of inertia in the legal system, whereby perhaps in the last century, the cases that reached the family courts were typically ones of very extreme abuse, and where it was much more likely to be the case than it is now that the woman was a dependent of her husband?
Well, I believe in the past that's certainly the case. In modern times, that's becoming less the case, as we know, as you know, things get more.
We know the legal system isn't exactly the most forward-thinking and reform-minded part of our society.
No, that's true. I mean, what I would say is that while it might be in the past that you had the sort of stereotypical family arrangement of the mother staying home and the father going out to work, even with that arrangement, I still don't necessarily think that the first sort of default should be the sort of provision system we have in our family court system, where the default position generally is that you're going to have mother stays home, has the home, the family home with children, usually until the youngest dependent is of age. And mm-hmm. then the father is allowed access and has to pay into the mortgage and maintenance. I would have said that a better starting point would be to say, we're going to try to have equal parent time for both parents, assuming they both can do it and want it.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, you look at the, you know, the nuances of the situation. Maybe one of them works too many hours for that to work.
To pick you up on one thing, to assume that parents want it, would you agree that by no means all cases, but there's a very significant chunk of cases whereby men simply walk out and have little or no interest to continue the emotional support and the upbringing of their children?
That certainly does happen. I have personal experience of that situation in my own life, and I
okay.
know people for whom that's happened.
And that, although it may occur, the proportion of times where that is done by a mother is insignificant in comparison.
Well, there was this very concerted campaign before the divorce referendum saying, you know, hello divorce, goodbye daddy.
Mm-hmm.
So people were absolutely convinced that the second it was allowed to have a divorce, there would be these hordes of men scrambling to abandon their families and run off across the horizon and leave them impoverished. That didn't happen. That didn't happen at all.
You're true that it's correct that there wasn't necessarily a huge uptick in that when divorce became available in 1995, I believe the referendum
yeah.
passed.
Yeah.
But that effect existed before and certainly didn't reduce after the introduction of divorce in Ireland. And I'm well aware of a particular practice which was, I think, perhaps more predominant in rural Ireland and was advised by some solicitors, and it was before DNA testing became available, so clearly before the divorce referendum, and the tactic was at a maintenance court hearing, that's to say, to use the language of the time, some guy had gotten a girl into trouble, she was
okay.
suing him for maintenance of the child, the legal format was that she then had to provide dates and times when she said that she had been with him and had the opportunity to have sex. He then essentially didn't respond and chose to lose the initial hearing, and then for the appeal rounded up a few of his friends and got them to swear an oath to say that they were out at a football match or out doing something else with him on each of those occasions. And of course, in the appeal, the woman was not entitled to introduce new evidence. And on that basis, the guy would avoid obviously having to pay any maintenance, but in addition having any contact with their child. That wasn't uncommon. That was a well-known tactic among a proportion of solicitors.
Okay.
My point being that it does appear that men are far more willing to essentially abandon their children than females. Isn't that a factor in what we're talking about?
I mean, it's always going to be a factor. Like I said, I have personal experience of this, but I'm not necessarily talking about, you know, men who don't want anything to do with their children. I don't approve of that. I certainly think they should take responsibility at the very least for children they brought into the world. But I'm talking specifically about cases where custody is contested or joint custody is sought, and the outcome that the average man will face going through that system. It's highly inequitable. It's been stated to be so numerous times, like I said, by Dr. O'Shea, who did her PhD in this area. Financial outcomes and contact with children outcomes for these men who are not looking to abandon their children, who are going through a very difficult time, their outcomes are very poor. And it's not necessarily discussed enough in the broader media, which is why it's one of our key issues. And by the way, the family law issue ties into a lot of other issues. It isn't a standalone issue. The phenomenon of fatherlessness, whether it's caused by male abandonment or by exclusion of the father from the family, is a big problem. It ties into the other issues we were talking about as well, like suicide and education inequality, homelessness. There's a huge correlation between these problems and crime, by the way, and fatherlessness. So
you mentioned suicide there. As I understand it, there is an enormous imbalance, gender imbalance, in the suicide statistics in Ireland. Why do you think that's the case?
That's a very difficult question to answer. Basically, the figures will hover somewhere in the region of 4 to 1. So 4 times more likely that a man is going to die by suicide.
Essentially, for every 5 people who die by suicide in Ireland, 4 of them are male.
That's correct.
And in the perhaps younger age group, so perhaps 15 to 35, there would be an enormous peak.
I believe so. I also believe that there is a rather large proportion of sort of more middle-aged men who are also dying by suicide. But that was in the recent statistics. And, you know, some people are saying that it's a holdover from the economic crash because a lot of them might have been employed in construction. For example,
it's also likely that there's very significant underreporting of suicide. And the point has been made that that same demographic also is much more likely to die in car accidents. And those two things may not be entirely distinct in the sense that people may use what is apparently a single car crash as a means of suicide, or people who are depressed may simply not take enough care to not avoid that. But, I mean, that level of an imbalance, 4 to 1 imbalance, that simply can't come from noise in the system. That's too extreme of an imbalance not
Absolutely,
to be accounted
yeah.
for. What would you suggest may account for that?
Well, I believe there are various risk factors. I've done some writing on this myself for the University Times, and I did some research into it. And there are various, you know, hypotheses going around for why this number tends to be so high and why it tends to be so high actually around the Western world in general, not just in Ireland.
Although so, Ireland is an extreme case.
I believe Ireland has some extremes to it, but even in cases where there are less overall suicides around the world, the proportion is generally maintained. So it's still somewhere hovers around 4 to 1, even if the absolute numbers aren't as high relative to the population as they are in Ireland. Well, we were just talking about family law and estrangement from family. So I think that's going to be a big factor. If you have been, you know, out working, for your whole life, supporting a family, and suddenly you are cut off from your children, you're on a very much lower income than you were before because you're supporting two households, you probably don't have the financial resources to sort of try and start again in a new life because you're supporting your family, which I think you should do, of course, but you're not exactly getting a lot of fulfillment out of it, maybe if you're not even able to see your children. That's going to be a big factor. And we know from statistics that a lot of the men who are dying by suicide, these men are separated or estranged from family in a huge proportion of cases. There's also, of course, mental illness and male mental health, which is a broader issue. It may well be the case that the services we have at the moment are not really doing it for men. They're not actually helping them to reach out.
Can I suggest one other thing that I think isn't perhaps discussed enough? And obviously throughout the 20th century, there's been huge changes in gender roles in Ireland. But most of those changes effectively were women making available to themselves roles that were previously either exclusive or overwhelmingly controlled by men. There hasn't really been an equal movement by men making roles that were previously predominantly female available to them. And so there's more competition for essentially the life roles that are seen as, shall we say, appropriate to men. Perhaps a proportion of men are seeing that there is nothing in life for them. Do you think that's a possibility? Because they're not considering roles that are previously not considered appropriate for males.
So you're saying that if they don't consider themselves to be capable of being, you know, a homemaker or a stay-at-home dad,
yeah,
they don't take those roles up.
Yeah, I mean, that might be acceptable in some tiers of society and more middle-class people, but if you come from a culture where male labour is very highly prized and it's not now available, that's quite unsettling to your psyche.
Absolutely. I mean, again, unemployment is another one of the markers for those men who die by suicide. And, you know, historically and even to modern times in Ireland, the way that men typically, I suppose you could say, show love is to work and provide and be the provider. So if that role is gone, if they're not doing that anymore, or they're not able to do it anymore, they might end up feeling sort of useless. And if they're not able to adapt to that sort of feeling of not being empowered, shall we say, mm-hmm. that might be, it may well be a marker for suicidal behavior. I think that men are getting more into the stay-at-home role. They're becoming more acclimatized to the fact that, you know, it's not enough just to go to work and come back. You've got to also be involved in your children's lives and so on. It's happening slowly. But as I said before, when talking about family law, I mean, there's still an assumption, a default assumption that the caring role should be fulfilled by the mother. So these things change slowly.
One thing I noticed on your website was that there's essentially six issues that obviously you see as being important within your remit. And one of the six is listed as false allegations of rape.
False allegations of child abuse and rape, yes.
Of child abuse and rape, yeah. Clearly, child abuse and rape are very hot topics and have been for a long time. False allegations of rape, is that, and obviously serious when it happens, but is it something that happens with a level of frequency that justifies it being one of the six topics that you think are the six most important topics for a men's group?
So are you saying, do these false allegations happen in anything like regularity?
Well, I'm saying, is it something that is sufficiently prominent to be in that top six?
I would say absolutely. Because
why is that?
Well, I mean, if you want to ruin somebody's life, there are very few crimes that people would not want to be guilty of more than child abuse or rape. I mean, these mm-hmm. people are the most despised people in society, even in among prison inmates. If you're a child abuser or a rapist, you're just the lowest of the low. So even if it's not, like, I'm not going to say we have an exact figure on how often this happens, because frankly, we don't. The statistics don't exist, or at least aren't very clear.
Well, there is one statistic which is quoted on your website, and it says a minimum of 9% of accusations, this is referring to rape, a minimum of 9% of accusations are provably false, and it provides a link for that. And there's two problems with that. One is that the link doesn't say what you say it says, or what the website says it says. And secondly, the link is a story in the Irish Independent which is 63 words long, which is very, very short indeed. It's basically just one of these like little snippet side column stories that you get in the newspaper. And the firstly, that Irish Independent story doesn't say what is quoted on the website. And secondly, it's referring to a supposed academic study that I haven't been able to find any backing for. Where do you get a minimum of 9% of accusations being provably false?
So I actually haven't been the person updating this website at least at the moment. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying here that if I'm quoting you correctly, it says that research carried out by Trinity College Dublin and London Metropolitan University mm-hmm. estimates that 9%. Okay. I'm not entirely sure what false means there to them. I have not read the study myself.
Well, it certainly gives the impression that 9% of victims who say they have been raped are lying.
I don't actually know what the raw numbers are. I mean, there was a case just two or three weeks ago of a woman was given a 3-year sentence for falsely reporting.
Because the statistics that I got, unfortunately, as you say, there doesn't seem to be any very good research on this in Ireland, but in the UK, the Crown Prosecution Service specifically addressed this. They studied all of the rape cases over a 17-month period starting in 2011. There were 5,651 prosecutions for rape, and in that period, there were 35 cases of prosecutions for making a false allegation. And Keir Starmer, the head of the CPS, said that the mere fact that someone did not pursue a complaint or retracted it is not in itself evidence that it was false, and that there was a misplaced belief that false accusations of rape are commonplace. He also said that in a significant number of false allegations of rape involved young, often vulnerable people, about half of the cases, the person making the false allegation were aged 21 years or under, and in some cases were people who had mental health difficulties and people who he said were undoubtedly the victim of some kind of offence, even if that was not the one that he or she had reported. That isn't the takeaway that you get from that website. And if one looks at a lot of the men's rights stuff that you see online, there's an enormous focus on a very, very small number of false allegations of mendacious and, you know, really vindictive lies.
Yes.
But do you think that placing what, as far as I can see, is a false statistic on your website, certainly one that is not supported by the source that you give, do you think that what it strikes me as is a little bit like Ulster Scots? And by that I mean that in the Northern Ireland negotiations for the Belfast Agreement, Sinn Féin pushed very hard for recognition of the Irish language. And Ulster Unionists came up with Ulster Scots, which they say is a distinctive language, and in reality it doesn't exist or barely exists. It's just the Northern Ireland accent.
Right, so they're playing it up.
And it really strikes me that it's sort of a me too. You know, you have a complaint, therefore we're going to make up a matching complaint. I find it extremely troubling and problematic that, you know, you rely on false statistics of something that is a problem when it occurs, but is nothing in comparison to the actual numbers of rapes in the society.
Well, I don't think we're saying that it's comparable to the number of rapes in society, because if we were, we would be claiming that it was 50%, for example. Mm-hmm. Let's forget about a specific number for a moment. Can we agree that one instance of this is not something you want to have in your society?
Absolutely.
And
that's true of any crime.
Of the accused, by the way. I'm also talking about this whole perception affects genuine victims as well.
Absolutely.
Because if
one person makes a false allegation, then that it makes life very difficult for 100 or 1,000 more, mostly women, who were genuinely raped.
Of course. And of course, child victims of abuse as well. If the problem is being sort of diluted by hysterical cases where it doesn't seem to have occurred, like, for example, the pursuit of Cliff Richard recently in the UK, that creates problems as well for genuine victims to come forward. So it isn't just a case of, oh, we want to promote the cause of men here. I mean, it's a problem, like I said, for society. And the same with our other issues that we
But is it a problem for... No, there's no question that's correct. Any crime, and that's a serious crime, and any crime is a problem for society. But is it one that justifies being on your top six? For example, men are not infrequently the victim of rape, and I think, although we don't have the statistics, I think it would not be outlandish to guess that men are far more likely to be the victim of rape than they are to be the victim of a false and mendacious rape accusation.
I see what you're saying. So you're saying that we should be more concerned with the men who are victims of rape than we are with the men who are victims of false allegations?
I'm not saying you should be more concerned, but I'm saying that it's entirely plausible that the former is much more common than the latter. And when you highlight the latter, in particular using questionable statistics, it gives the impression of a level of sympathy with people who may or may not be rapists that I think is inappropriate.
Well, we only know if people are or are not rapists by going through, you know, a adversarial court system. Mm-hmm. That's how you determine if someone has committed a heinous crime like that or not, quite simply.
How the courts determine that. But there's no question that only a small proportion of rapes are prosecuted successfully.
That's true.
That leaves quite a large proportion of rapists unpunished for their crimes. And putting this narrative out in the ether of how there's some hugely exaggerated proportion of women making entirely false and mendacious accusations of rape, is that not damaging?
If we put out a narrative that there are rapists...
Put out a narrative that, as we know, only a small proportion of rapes are successfully prosecuted, putting out this narrative really is encouraging the belief that in every other case, it was some woman looking to get revenge or get money out of a poor innocent guy, which is not the case.
I don't think that, let's assume for a moment that the figure we quoted is accurate, even if we... look at that figure, we said it was 9%. So the most you could glean from that figure is that 9% of the cases need to be looked at as with skepticism and the remaining 81 don't.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that that number would create a narrative that it's always this case of women lying or men lying or child victims making it up. I don't think that's fair to say.
Well, that's not true, because one thing that I've noticed, and I did a bit of background research on this, and if you follow through searches and blogs and so forth from not yours, but from other men's rights websites, you very quickly land, especially on YouTube channels, which specialize in editing together news reports of women being prosecuted for making false allegations of rape. Now, that's obviously a tiny number. As we saw in the UK, there were 35 prosecutions, but 35 prosecutions make an awful lot of news reports. And that's quite uncomfortable, isn't it? That the narrative behind that is all these women, and one of the phrases that's used quite often, all these women crying rape. And obviously that's an allusion to the Peter and the Wolf fable of crying wolf, in other words, falsely making complaints. Using that sort of language, you know, referring to a victim as somebody who cries rape, that's really disgusting, isn't it?
Referring to a genuine victim as somebody who cries rape?
No, referring to somebody who makes a criminal complaint as somebody who cries rape.
I'm sorry, I actually haven't seen these videos which you're referring. I don't really pay much attention to other men's groups, to be honest.
Well, fair enough, but I did research and it wasn't something that I sought out. I just, you know, followed links on various websites, having done a Google search on that. And really, that was like a narrative that you could not avoid.
So you're saying that these videos depict cases of prosecution of false allegations.
There's just a huge number of videos, and it's really just cutting together mostly American local news reports.
Right. So let's say they have 30 cases, and you're saying that this kind of creates the impression that it's everywhere.
Yes, yes, yes.
Well, I would say, look, if you're being fed information from any source, whether it's a group or a content creator or a news site, you know, the impression you get from it is going to vary from person to person. So I'm a scientist is my background. So my impression would be to look at the raw numbers there and say, oh, there's 30 cases here, but there's probably thousands upon thousands of genuine cases. So be aware that the problem exists. Be aware that it can happen. Don't pretend it doesn't happen, because it might. There's a narrative going around often that you shouldn't talk about potentially false allegations because that discourages real victims from coming forward. I disagree. I think that our system
is
set
up for the inverse. But it should be kept in proportion, and making it one of the top six headlines on your website doesn't seem proportionate to me.
Okay. Well, I think that we have discussed this much less than the other issues that I was talking about earlier. Honestly, it's not something we sit around talking about all day. How are we going to talk about this? Primarily, the other issues on the website are discussed in far greater degree. And indeed, we're looking to organize an event around International Men's Day. And that issue will not actually be featured in our talks, because frankly, the other ones are taking up more time and are given more importance. But because even if it's a minority number of cases happening, because it's such a serious allegation and such a damaging one, it really doesn't matter if it's only a few cases a year. It should still be discussed, and it should still be out there in the, in the ether for people to consider.
Okay, you said it's such a serious and damaging allegation. That's not always true. And there was the case, you may remember, of Danny Foley from Meen in Listowel, who was found guilty of raping a 24-year-old woman. There was CCTV and witness evidence against him, even though he pleaded not guilty. When he was brought for sentencing, after having been convicted, this is from an Irish Examiner report, a group of 50 people, mainly men, said to be neighbours and friends, trooped into the courtroom and marched up to the accused, each in single file. Each man shook his hand, some hugged him warmly with tears in their eyes. And this included the parish priest. And this was witnessed by the 24-year-old victim, who was with one or two other people in the public gallery. That doesn't suggest a culture where an accusation, or in this case, even a conviction for rape, destroys your position in society.
So this one particular case.
Well, it's a very extreme case.
I mean, perhaps I don't actually know anything about this case personally. Perhaps they don't believe he was guilty, even if he was found guilty in court, which very often happens for any crime.
You find cases of murder with evidence including CCTV accused, which proved that he had lied.
Right, you find cases where people are convicted of murder, provably convicted of murder with good evidence, and their family still doesn't believe that they did it and supports them. Does that mean that we don't take murder seriously? Or that being accused of murder isn't damaging?
Well, this isn't the family. This seems to be the entire townland.
Yeah, it could be the entire townland.
And I'm also aware that the victim was, after Danny Foley was sent to prison, the victim was further victimized and boycotted in that town.
I feel very bad. I think that's a terrible thing to happen. However, I still think that, you know, especially in the modern age, accusations of these kind of crimes is, you know, extremely damaging. People don't look kindly upon that kind of violating behavior. It's not actually tolerated in the way that some people imply that it might be. I don't think that it is.
I want to move on to one other thing, and that's males in education, and both on the teacher and on the student side. I know that you highlight that on your website. Maybe first of all, tell me what's your kind of main concern on that.
I suppose the main concern that we would have is that when you look at the numbers on things like early school leaving, dropping out of university, likelihood of going to university, boys are falling behind hugely. They are not doing as well as they could be doing. Mm-hmm. Their participation is lower, and their success in pedagogy is lower.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I mean, it's, in, to my mind, it's rather important to say, okay, we want all our students, regardless of gender, to be achieving their potential. Why are they doing worse? What can we do to sort of ameliorate the situation?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if looking at universities, I think the female to male ratio is 60-40. I mean, that's a huge gap.
I think it's not quite that, but now more women are being, or young women, girls are being admitted to university. You're correct that males make up less than 50% of admissions. And you list here that, in subjects like law, medicine, languages, and I think from my own memory, also biology,
yes.
Women
yes.
predominate.
They do,
but
yeah.
men predominate in other fields, particularly physics and engineering. Why do you think those subjects are being gendered?
Why do I think physics and engineering are gendered and biology?
Clearly all of them are gendered, but just some of them are gendered a different way.
So you asked me why do I think that men are doing physics and women are doing biology in greater
essentially,
proportion?
Essentially, yeah.
Well, that's a rather fundamental question. I mean, there have been some studies done on, you know, young children, even babies, and they find that there tends to be a greater proportion of, you know, female children who are interested in people, faces, human contact, and little boys on average tended to be more interested in if they were shown like some sort of mechanical object or something with moving parts. So mm-hmm. it might be that there is some element of inbuilt personal preference. Mm-hmm. Perhaps guys are more likely to want to be hands-on and do engineering, and girls are more likely to do science with a human being. So biology, mm-hmm. Veterinary science, medicine.
Those are female dominated.
Yes. So maybe that working with people and solving people problems is more something that women tend to gravitate towards compared to men, who tend to gravitate towards problem solving that is not directly related to people.
But essentially the question is nature or nurture. How would you see that breakdown?
The endless debate. I mean, it's obviously a feature of both. I don't think you can entirely put it down to either. I mean, people are saying it's all nature, it's all born, or people saying it's all socially constructed. I don't think either of them are right. I'm pretty sure that it's going to be a bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there was a documentary made, I think it was in Norway a few years ago, and it was about this entire topic. And Norway, I think, is the most gender egalitarian country just going in terms of all the metrics they use to measure it, all the initiatives they put into place to try and get mm-hmm. gender parity across the board. And they could not get, no matter what they tried, they could not get as many men into, you know, social science, psychology, nursing, and they could just not get the women to do engineering. So, I mean, maybe.
It's notable that's not always true because, for example, in Iran, which you would not imagine was a beacon for gender equality, the overwhelming number of engineering students are women.
Yes, but you have to remember that we talk about Norway and this country, we're talking about Western liberal democracies with welfare states and support networks. You're talking about a lot of countries like China, Iran, Russia, that tends to be closer to gender parity because those careers we mentioned tend to be higher paying and there's not as much of a choice. So when you remove the economic barrier to careers and you allow people to kind of have a bit of flexibility in what they choose to do, because they might want to be fulfilled and have a fulfilling life rather than make money, you tend to see this gender inequality appearing in, you know, physics versus biology, hard science versus social science.
Well, one thing that strikes me, and I've seen it in research about childhood obesity, it is striking, and this is mainly in the UK and the US, although we tend to have the same type of figures, it is striking that actually it's hitting females, that's to say young girls, more than young boys, because girls don't run around as much. And whether it's nature or nurture, it seems to me it's the case that the two kind of stereotypical things for young girls are, you know, looking after a baby, maybe, you know, a young sibling or cousin or whatever, and reading books. And they feel, especially if they're already slightly overweight, they feel perhaps self-conscious about active play. Is it possible, because it strikes me that, and you list the subjects, law, medicine-related disciplines, education, languages, they're the things that are associated, A, with either, you know, kind of the caring professions or the very bookish professions where you have to kind of be sitting there with a book in your hand, whether it's a Harry Potter book or I think it suits those type of that image. Do you think there's anything in that?
We know that the current education system, being bookish and being able to learn large amounts of information, is sort of the gold standard, you know, the main skill you need to have. Mm-hmm. And we know that girls are more likely to read, especially fiction, from a young age or in general than boys are. So yeah, I think there could be something in that. But that's still, I mean, if you're looking at early school leaving and so on, these problems, that's, I think, more concern, at least from my point of view, individually, than do we need to have parity in law or medicine.
Yeah, you mentioned that 85% of primary school teachers are female. Is that concerning?
Well, I think, especially when we talked about earlier the problem of fatherlessness, I'm just going to backtrack for 1 second and say that, you know, I think it's around 1 in 4 families in this country now are single parent, and close to 90% of those are going to be fatherless. And then you go to primary school where you spend the majority of your time when you're not at home, and majority of the teachers are going to be female. So, mm-hmm. And that's all the way through education as well, even through secondary school. So that's not to say that these people aren't good teachers, but the question would be, you know, where are the male role models?
Yeah, we had an election recently whereby parties were required to have a minimum number of female candidates, and indeed one party, Renewal, was punished by reduced state funding.
Yes.
Because they didn't meet that. And one of the arguments for that was that having more female politicians would create role models for more young women to enter politics. Do you think that role models are more important lower down the line, as, for example, a primary school teacher than a politician?
Well, personally, I think that when you're talking about kids, they're not going to have a clue who politicians are, but they're going to be seeing their teacher every single day. So the role model you have on a day-to-day basis is, yeah, I think it's far more important than who's at the top of the hierarchy politically.
But should we have gender quotas for primary teachers?
Well, I'm actually going to speak individually here. I don't think that Men's Voices has a position on it, but personally, I'm very against gender quotas. I think it's very important to have more male teachers, but I don't think a gender quota is the way to go about doing it, because I think it's unfair on the girls who are doing very well in their, you know, in their leaving cert to get the points to do primary school teaching. It's a lot of work. There's a lot of high points needed. There's a lot of studying required. So I think encouraging boys to go into the area through other means is more important than having a forced quota, because at the end of the day, what's most important about a teacher is your teaching ability. So It is very important to try and bring that number closer to parity, but I think it's more important to find ways to do it that don't push other people down, especially if those people have greater merit.
James Behan, spokesperson for Men's Voices, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you very much.
Make your view heard. Dial 076-603-5060 and leave a contribution for the show. You can find tips on how to record a good contribution and other ways to contact the podcast at hereshow.ie/call.
That's almost the end of episode 44 of Here's How, Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast, published on the 24th of July, 2016. I've got links to the Men's Voices site and to some of the reports and research that I talked about with James in this episode's show notes on the website. If you can think of a topic that should be covered in the next show, or if you want to suggest someone to include, that could be yourself, then let me know. If you like the podcast, please go on iTunes and give it a rating, or even write a nice review. Also, please like the show on Facebook, follow the podcast on Twitter at Here's How Podcast, and subscribe to the podcast so new shows automatically come up in your podcast feed. You can use iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, or any other podcast app or software. If you don't know how to do that, there are step-by-step instructions along with contact details at www.hereshow.ie. The next show will be uploaded shortly. The Here's How podcast is produced and presented by me, William Campbell. Thank you for listening.